It's our privilege to have one of our own here with us this week, John Dyer, who is our Executive Director for Communications and Educational Technology. He's been a web developer for more than 15 years, building tools used by Apple, Microsoft, Anheuser-Busch, Harley-Davidson, WordPress, and the Department of Defense. If you were not here yesterday, he's developed Bible software for use in closed countries, and hundreds of thousands of copies have been distributed. He has his THM from DTS, and he is currently a PhD candidate at Durham University. His interests include science, technology, ultimate frisbee, and figuring out what it means to love Jesus. At one point, he patented a molecule. You can ask him about that on another occasion. He currently serves, as I said, as our Director of Communications, Educational Technology. He writes on issues of technology and faith for publications like Gizmodo, Christianity Today. He's the author of the book, From the Garden to the City, The Redeeming and Corrupting Power of Technology. And he and his wife live in Irving with their two delightful children. John, thank you for spending the time to prepare for this week amidst all your other responsibilities. Would you join me in welcoming back to our platform, John Dyer?
Thanks, Dr. Dyer. Okay.
Well, thank you for having me again. It was a pleasure to be with you yesterday. And you know, yesterday we talked about this idea of a dance with light, and we read a prayer from an old Book of Common Prayer where people used to often pray and thank God for getting them through the night. And now that prayer has been removed from the Book of Common Prayer with electric lighting. So we talked about how technology is this wonderful thing that we use to shape the world, and yet it in turn shapes us. And my daughter was here yesterday, and she drew this of me yesterday. So there's me with a curly hair and speaking. So, and she really liked the remote, so that was a big part of her life yesterday. So today I tried to create a title that would be too long for Twitter, so here it is. New Media, the Virtualization of Culture and the Need for Embodied Places and Practices. So we'll extend what we've been talking about of the need for artists and coders and pastors and theologians all to be talking together to help navigate this new media world that we're in. So first, though, I want to introduce you to this guy. His name is Chuck McCarthy, and he lives in Los Angeles, and he's an aspiring actor. He says he grew his beard so he could play homeless people, and he's trying to figure out what he would do for work in between. And so what he's decided to do is to set up a people-walking business. So he puts ads on Craigslist, and what he's found is that there are so many people in the Los Angeles area that are just so lonely, basically. They have no one just to go on a walk with, no one to talk with, no one who will listen, and no one who will keep them company and be safe with them. And so he's now making $7 an hour walking people around Los Angeles. The people feel so displaced and disconnected that he's come up with a business for this. And I think this is emblematic of where we are. You know, if we think back to maybe the early 80s or 90s as the internet is starting to come online, there were these worries that, you know, there would be sort of your online life and your offline life, right? That there would be this complete separation, and there would be these stories about people who were married in their real life, and then they would go online, and they would have this whole second life, literally, and they would marry somebody else, and that was the worry that things would go that way. Well, it's turned out that's not really what happened, right? We have a much more connected world where we are on and off of our phones all day long, and so it becomes part of our lives, not this separate world out there, but it's who we are. And there's a lot of wonderful benefits that we've talked about yesterday, and a lot of beautiful things that we can create, like the videos we saw today. And yet there's also this rapid change. So this is when Pope Benedict was elected. You can see the one person rocking the flip phone in the corner, right? And then here's when the cool new Pope came. This is what it looked like. You can see just how fast things have changed in the last decade or so. And yet, as we are starting to learn how to use phones, we're also learning how to experience the world, how to experience our children growing up, how to experience concerts, how to experience events. And are we really there, or are we using our phones? Or is it okay just to snap a few photos? Is that totally normal? And you can see here this one woman, she seems to have this sort of serene view that she's, whatever they are enjoying here, she seems to be enjoying it in a different way than the other people are. And yet, using your phones is sort of part of modern day life, right? And yet sometimes it can be pretty detrimental at the same time. We're raising a group of kids who are watching us. They are observing our patterns. They're seeing how we use them to one day want to emulate those things. And so they're wanting to learn from us, and we're trying to figure it out as well. You know, there's these studies out there about people going onto Facebook and wanting to have a great experience with their friends, and yet coming away feeling a little bit more depressed. And just about whatever stage you're in, there's this thing, right, where if you're single and you long to be married, then everybody's getting married online, right? If you have small children and they're throwing up on you all night, then everybody else is going on an awesome date, right? Or if you're an empty nester and you're at home and it seems like everybody else has more money to go on vacations, right? There's always these things that are out there that we end up comparing ourselves to, and we want to go online, and yet we feel bummed about it at the same time. Even when I go on Facebook, I guess I don't post enough, and so Facebook was reminding me that 150 of my friends had posted, but I had not said anything cool. And I didn't have anything cool to say, so I didn't post, you know? So that's how it went. And we read these stories about people who look back at their Instagram life and they sort of realize that they were maybe making a life that wasn't really real. This woman, Asena O'Neill, is one of the famous cases of someone who is just so beautiful in every single picture, and yet she went back and edited every single one of her pictures to say, you know, that it might take her over 100 photos to do these things, or how little she ate for that week before that, or what company sent her that so that they would advertise for her. And yet there is this constant fear of not having your phone with you, right? We're more afraid of losing our phone than our keys. It's become this extension of who we are. And we're afraid to be anywhere, to even not sleep without our phone nearby us. So you would think that this is just about the kids, right? That it's all just about the youngins with their devices. But it turns out that the younger generations are actually less likely to use their phones during meals than older generations are. Yeah. So this is across, what I mean to say is not to make fun of anybody, only to say that this affects all of us. We're all struggling to know how to navigate this world. There was one particular study I want to share with you too that I thought was really, really important about this idea of technology communicating even when it doesn't have any words on it. And in this study, they would pair up pairs of people to talk about something, and some of them would talk about something mundane like what they had eaten that day, and some of them would talk about something more important like what was the biggest thing that happened to them this year. And they would make one change to the environment. In some of the rooms, they would have a book on a table, and in other rooms, they would have a table. They would have a phone on the table, and that phone wasn't either of the people's phones. It didn't go off or anything like that. It was just there as a background decoration. And they would ask people, how did you feel after this conversation? And the people that talked about, you know, their meals, they were both great. But the people that had the more serious conversation, those that had the book in the room, they said, man, that was really good for me. I really enjoyed that, even though this was a stranger. But when the phone was in the room, people reported feeling more disconnected and fearful and uncomfortable, even though the phone didn't go off. And it shows the power of that device to say, there's a world out there that's more important than is here. So the authors of the study end up concluding that an environment without a phone is one that can foster connectedness, interpersonal trust, and perceptions of empathy. So I think as all of us are trying to figure out how do we listen well, how do we conduct small groups, how do we do that, probably having the phone not be visible would be an important thing. For all of the fantastic benefits that phones have for online education and Bible reading and all of these things, it also has this power to shape our own spaces and affect how we interact with this. So what we want to do is to extend our conversation yesterday about technology and talk more about this theme of placelessness, and that the video this morning did a really good job of introducing us to this. And we think about the biblical story that we walked through yesterday, and we saw all the different places where God cared deeply about human creativity and making and technology. If we think about it a different way, we can think about the story of Scripture in some way as people having a place and then going to an area of displacement, and then finally coming back and having replacement. Now, I don't mean replacement theology. This is a different thing here, okay? So what we mean by this is that, you know, it starts out where the entire world is meant to be part of our dominion. We're supposed to go out there and to enjoy this, to make things from the world that God has made. And yet sin enters into the world, and then we experience this kind of displacement where we are somewhere, and yet we have a constant sense that we're not where we're supposed to be, right? We all experience this displacement. And our hope is not to leave this world, but it's for God to remake this world and to come back to a place where we are now experiencing place in the way that it was meant to be experienced. And this movement, this maybe dialectic, if you will, is seen through lots of stories in Scripture. When Abraham is called, he's totally fine where he is. He likes that place. And yet God asks him to go to a new place, and he experiences this displacement for several years as he's kind of going around and trying to figure out, how do I leave behind everything that I know and to go somewhere else where God is eventually going to take me? So you see this in the story of Abraham. You see it in Israel when they were in Egypt, and they come out of that, and they have this displacement throughout their journey through the desert, where they literally had no place and no home, and they are wandering through the desert to eventually get to the land that God will show them. And I think this is one of the advantages here at DTS of the dispensational tradition, is we take this very seriously, that this whole idea of land is really true, and that we want to see Israel replaced, and then all of us to be replaced in the entire world. So the story of the Bible moves this way in its overall arc, and also in some of the many arcs throughout it. But then we also, now today, we have an experience of this in our own world. So in the world that we talk about, where we talk about pre-modernity and then modernity and then post-modernity, there's a lot of problems with pre-modernity, right? I mean, there is wanton misplacement, mistreatment of women. There is terrible feudalism. There's disease, all kinds of bad things. So I don't want to make it sound like we want to go back to that era. And yet, in that era, it seems as though people were more deeply connected to their communities, to their families, to their land, to their place. And then modernity comes in, and you have this radical idea of the individual. So Descartes starts us with that concept of, I think, therefore I am. Rather than me being defined by the God above or in the culture or family where I was raised, now I'm defined by my own self-thinking thoughts, right? And this continues on into postmodernity, where we become the center of the universe. And this affords great freedom for us. It may be enables democracy, and science comes out of the Enlightenment, and all these wonderful things. And yet, this radical individuality means that we are often feel disconnected from the world. And we don't really know, how do we get back? What do we do with this world in which we now live? What I'd like to argue is that for all of new media's wonderful things that it offers us, it can also exacerbate what was happening in modernity. It can also further entrench us in the sense of radical individualism. So when you pull out your phone, you have the phone that you bought, and you have your apps and your arrangement, and it's all about you. And so as much as it offers us in wonder and in joy and in beauty and in videos and in pictures of our children, it also offers us this kind of self-focus, which can be damaging and displacing to us. So to help us understand this a little bit more, what I want to do is to delve into this concept of culture. And I should say that in the few minutes that we're going to spend on this, I'm going to go over things that are much better handled by some of the professors here from, you know, Glenn Kreider and Daryl Bach and Sandy Glenn and Rodney Orr and all the rest. Glenn Kreider, again, I can't remember if I said him twice, but Glenn Kreider. There are so many here who can offer so much wisdom. Dr. Baselin there, that can offer us so much. So I'm just going to give us a brief introduction to some of these ideas. But if you think about culture, there's a lot of discussions out there of high culture and low culture, and how do these all work? The things I'd like you to know today, one of them is just to think that there are, of course, no one culture. It's not Christ versus culture. There are multiple of these. And so we exist maybe as in Christian culture or in American culture, and there's some overlap of those. I'm from San Antonio, so I have a bit of Southern culture in me. I like to say y'all and make websites like y'all version, things like that. I also have a little bit of nerd culture in me, so all these are overlapping. And there are other cultures that I'm not a part of, that I don't know as much about. So there's African-American culture and Asian culture, all of which are distinct, and I have to listen very, very well to my African-American and Asian and Latino brothers and sisters in order to understand, because I didn't grow up that way. And so the black experience in America is very different from the white male heterosexual experience in America, right? All of these are different, and they're overlapping in very complicated ways, and we all share from different ones. Now, when we think about these, when we think about cultures, we often think primarily about what a culture believes in. But really, it's probably better to think about some of these other elements that are out there, about the language. They say that if you want to know a culture very well, you want to learn their language, right? That is what's going to give you real insight into who they are. There are things, or some people call them artifacts, that make up a culture and how they operate. There are rituals, and I don't mean lighting incense to a god or something like that. I mean the patterns of behavior. So in American culture, we are very consumeristic, and so our daily lives revolve around going out and buying things and using those things. And there's also certain images in the way that we think about ourselves, and all of these take place in particular spaces or places. So when we think about, you know, American culture, we have a set of words that mean things to us, right? Election means something here and might mean something in a different group. And we have Thanksgiving, but other countries don't have that. So even though we share the same language of English, we have things that are American specific. We have images about our own ability to do it on our by ourselves. We can pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. So I don't mean this image literally, but I mean what this image says about who we are as a people. We have all kinds of rituals in our country, right? From sports to buying things to makeup and all the rest. All of these things form part of who we are as America. We have things, we have spaces which are primarily, again, for buying things, right, in America. But all of these form what it means to be American. And in Christian culture, we have a variety of things that make up who we are as well. We have election, which means something very different. So if you walk down the street and you say, what do you think about the election? They say, gosh, I can't wait for November 9th. And you're like, what? That it means something different in this case. And other words like love on them kind of makes sense to us, but might feel weird outside of Christian culture. You know, it's kind of an interesting phrase. So we have internal language that separates us from other people. Right? We have images within Christianity of the cross, of Jesus' great sacrifice for us that makes such a difference in our lives. We don't think of ourselves as evangelicals of having a lot of rituals, right? But we still have two songs, announcements, two songs, sermon, one song, right? It's very liturgical and ordered, isn't it? So we have that as well. And we have things and we have spaces. All of these things make up our understanding of probably this is very a very American version of Christianity, of course. And nerd culture exists too. We have lots of things that make up us. And depending on how many of these references you get, you may or may not be part of nerd culture. But the way all of these things work is kind of interesting. Because if we think about even this room, the way that these objects work is that if you think about the way the chairs are arranged in this room and the podium, these all say something, don't they? They have a meaning and a value system. So by some kind of magic, we know that this is a lecture, right? And we know that you are a learner and I am a speaker, right? At least for the few minutes. And that it values what I'm going to say, not what the audience is going to say. Now, these very same objects could be rearranged in a different manner, and it would have a very different meaning for us, wouldn't it? So it would tell us that this is a group, and your identity would become something else, and we would value hearing from everybody. So even something as mundane as a chair, which remember in The Passion of the Christ, Jesus invented in that one scene, even something as important as a chair can send to us a set of values and meaning and identity. And this is happening all around us at all times. All the things around us from all these images and objects are saying something to us. So what do we do when we drop this new device into